You're listening to Clause 8, the voice of IP. Today's guest, Gaston Krub.
Anytime we're talking about a patent case where there's literal discussion of whether the two owners of the company are going to like engage in some kind of MMA battle, I think we're in for a lot of interesting possibilities going forward. Perhaps a lot more interesting than just, you know, another Texas case that gets filed and, you know, Facebook files some IPRs and a motion to transfer to the Northern District of California. So stay tuned. It's a very interesting ride that we may be in for.
Clause 8 is part of IP Watchdog and sponsored by Harrity, the go-to firm for the Patent 300 for patent preparation and prosecution. After you're done listening to this episode, don't forget to share it with others, and please leave a 5-star rating wherever you're listening now. And now here's your host, Eli Mazur.
All right. Welcome, everyone, to Clause 8. This is a special episode. I saw the news about Twitter come out, specifically Elon Musk's go-to lawyer, Alex Spiro, sending a letter to Meta saying they're possibly stealing trade secrets and infringing on other IP rights. And when I saw that, I've been following Twitter's patent portfolio for a long time. That piqued my interest because I think I first started to look at their portfolio when they released their innovators patent agreement, which basically promised not to use their portfolio offensive unless one of the conditions was met, which nobody dug into too much. And obviously, they acquired a lot of patents when they had the IPO. And then, you know, once Musk tried to acquire them, I went to look, well, what's happened with their patent portfolio since? And they basically didn't have much of a portfolio for a company that size. I think they were getting maybe 60 patents a year compared to some of their biggest competitors who get about 1,000 patents a year. So when the news came out about that letter, I said, well, I don't think there's much of a trade secret case here, but maybe there's a patent infringement case with their small portfolio. And I said, maybe there's some foundational patents that are buried in there somewhere that are valuable. And I started thinking more and more, and then I said, well, maybe none of this really matters once they start the litigation. And then I said, you know, if I'm going to do an episode about this, I need to have one of my earliest guests on the Clause 8 podcast, Gaston Krub, back on to game this out with me. He does this for a living. That's kind of was the inspiration for his firm and for his Markman advisors. He was one of my earliest guests, but whenever somebody asked me what episode they should go listen to, if it's a young associate or a young attorney, I always recommend his episode. And I was listening to his episode myself, and I'm like, I should have been listening to it again and again all these years. Lots of good advice in there. So if you haven't listened to it, please go back to listen to it. But Gaston, thanks for coming on and doing this.
My pleasure, Eli. Great to talk to you again.
Elon Musk is known in the patent world. I don't know if anybody outside the patent world pays attention to this, but he has a disdain for patents. He said things like patents are for the weak, implying, you know, companies really shouldn't invest in their patent portfolio. Interestingly, the letter that I mentioned didn't mention patents. So who knows why that is. So this is all, I guess, somewhat speculative, our discussion today. But Gaston and I were talking about this beforehand. He has publicly continued to accuse Threads of being a copycat. And it's not that surprising in terms of, regardless, I guess, what any company says about patents theoretically, when they think their company has invested billions of dollars into building something up, and then somebody else just, in their mind, maliciously just steals it, they're like, that's just not right. And, you know, they don't have quite a word for it once not right about it, but like, this can't be done. And, you know, they're looking for some kind of rights, and, you know, part of it is could be patents. And I'm just guessing this is might have had unfolded. Elon Musk decides, calls Alex Spiro up, and says, I don't think what happened is right. Is there anything that we could do about it? Alex Spiro, who's a well-known attorney, but he practices in a lot of different areas, goes to a top patent litigation attorney in his firm, and he goes, what can we do on the IP front? What do you think he might have said before they drafted that letter?
So, You know, I think, you know, to start, it's important to keep in mind that one of the things that makes IP litigation so interesting is it's an emotional business. We don't think about the importance of emotion in IP claims, but if you really think about why inventors are motivated to go sue companies that they think are infringing their patents, or why you see copyright creators, you know, go after people that they think are copying them, emotion plays a large role. So the job, I think, of a lawyer that is, you know, looking to represent someone like Elon Musk, who has already espoused some of the emotional language, like the word copycat, and is saying it publicly with respect to what Facebook has been doing or Meta has been doing with respect to Threads. One of the jobs of the outside litigation attorney is to say, okay, we understand that you're upset, but we also want to make sure that the claims that we bring are the strongest possible claims. And that, you know, involves, I think, a multi-layered analysis that needs to be done. And what we're seeing so far is Quinn Emanuel and Alex Spiro sent a letter basically accusing, using the fact that Threads and Meta have hired a lot of former Twitter employees to say, hey, you know, we just want you to know that we're watching, right? You guys are now officially on notice that we are going to be very, very, let's say, cognizant of any proof that any of our trade secret information was used in developing your product. We suspect that it is, but we're going to continue to monitor you. So you are now officially on notice that we are looking into a potential trade secret claim against you. That would be one, you know, that's obviously an easy step to take and a good way to send a message without having to go so far as to actually file a case. The other thing that would I would imagine would be done by Quinn Emanuel's patent litigators is to start mining the portfolio of patents that Twitter has or has access to and say, you know, if we wanted to file a case alleging patent infringement, either only based on patent infringement or patent infringement in combination with a trade secret or copyright or other type of IP claim, which patents would we use? Now, Twitter's portfolio may not be as big as some of its competitors, but they do have assets. And, you know, part of the process is going to be, you know, looking through those potential patents, starting the process of claim charting against features that Threads already has, and trying to determine whether or not there is the potential to combine patent infringement claims with whatever other type of IP claims that Elon Musk might, you know, feel the company should pursue in order to deal with this competitive threat that is newly arisen. So, you know, on the one hand, you want to manage your client's expectations and not overpromise and say, oh my God, yeah, for sure we could sue them and we could use, you know, we could put them in the ground with all the firepower we're going to bring to bear. On the other, you want to be cautious in your approach, bring claims that you believe are actually strong, and those claims require some diligence and some preparation. And I would imagine that that's part of what's happening over on the Twitter legal team, to the extent that they really think that litigation is imminent or something that they should be pursuing.
So obviously, I've expressed my skepticism about the trade secrets. From my perspective, that's based on, you know, to prove a trade secret claim civilly, you have to prove that there was a reasonable measures taken to protect trade secrets. I think companies could take that seriously. They call that trade secret programs. There's a lot of case law that put a pretty high bar on that. And I have no set of knowledge, but for me, it's hard to imagine that if they didn't have a strong patent program, that they had strong measures in place to protect trade secrets or so forth. Why do you think they led with that in the letter?
I think the answer is that it was an easy letter to write. It's much easier to write that letter than it would be to, you know, to start putting together claim charts on short notice and, you know, making some patent related allegations. I think if we, you know, if you really parse the letter, a lot of it is just trying to put Threads on notice and say, hey guys, we're watching you. We know what you've done in terms of hiring our employees. there's some element of risk whenever you hire an employee, because even if you're hiring an employee from a company that has a robust, you know, trade secret protection program, you're still kind of at the mercy of the individual employee and what they may or may not have done when they left the company. So I think on the one, you know, I think for one, it was an easy letter to write to, you know, especially if Quinn Emanuel or Alex Spiro was under pressure from Mr. Musk to do something, right? Send a letter, let's make it public. And I think it, you know, whenever you're thinking about litigation, I also like to think of what I call the marketing impact of things, right? So it made the news. And it's starting to build the narrative, which we saw, you know, going back to the Apple-Samsung patent battles. You know, I always thought that Apple did a great job, starting with Steve Jobs himself, of really making the case about who's the innovator and who's the copycat. And I think what we're seeing Twitter try to do is say, we're the innovator, you know, Threads, you're the latecomer, you're the copycat. And, you know, starting to build that narrative both internally and externally, that this is a case about protecting innovation. It's just a smart approach in my view, you know, while also leaving your options open to escalate or de-escalate depending on what happens next. So the value of the letter, it helps put them on notice. It helps start creating this narrative in the media and in the general public. And like I said, it's probably a much easier letter to write than one that would have a more robust, you know, laying out of allegations of patent infringement or other types of infringement where you would need some more analysis done before you can make such specific claims.
When they're looking through a portfolio, what do you think they're looking for?
I think you always have to think about your target, right? And what do we know about Meta and what do we know about Meta's approach to patent infringement cases? The reality is that Meta, you know, with I think a recent example where they lost, Meta has a really strong track record of using the IPR system to defend themselves. And I think the expectation of anybody bringing a patent lawsuit against Meta, including Twitter, has to be that whatever patents we pick, whether we find 3, 5, 10, whatever patents we pick, those patents are going to have to go through the IPR process and survive if our claims are going to survive. So what do we prioritize? I think to start, you always want to prioritize claims, patents that you have a very strong infringement claim based on, right? Because if you start trying to assert patents where non-infringement is something that the defendant can easily show, you're really hurting yourself more than you're helping yourself. Nothing stops a patent case in its tracks more than the defendant being able to say, actually, there's no infringement here, and here's why. So I think the priority has to be, you know, let's identify from our pool of patents which patents have claims that, you know, are being infringed by Threads. And being infringed by Threads today. I think that's the number one factor in the analysis.
And we're recording this on July 18th, 2023, and news, I think, came out last night that Tesla is involved in some patent litigation dispute. I guess it stems from a company that they acquired, but they are filing a suit in another in the Texas district because of that. All right, so let's say, you know, they're able to come up with a group of assets that makes sense. What do you think happens next? And they get that call to file suit. Where do you think they file suit and how do you think it plays out?
Yeah, so I mean, I think I would be a little wary if I were Twitter of just filing a patent infringement lawsuit unless I was really convinced that that's the only type of IP claim I could bring, right? So, you know, the first, before you pull the trigger on any complaint, you want to make sure that you've run to ground all the potential IP claims that you could raise, whether they lie in trade secret, trademark. I know Twitter, Threads, I don't know if that's something that you know, could be a trademark type of issue, because you definitely see the word Threads associated with tweets, right? Before Meta started Threads, when I heard the word Threads and you say Threads and Twitter, you're talking about a Twitter thread, right? And I don't know if they have any IP around that, whether in you know, federal registration or common law trademark rights in that. But even if that's not the case, I think part of the responsibility of the law firm and the in-house team at Twitter is to really do a regimented analysis of all the different areas of IP that could come into play. If they, you know, analyze if there's any source code published, make sure that they're not copying your source code. I doubt that that's available, but maybe there are pieces or ways for them to have access to that. Like I said already, you could look at or consider potential claims around trademark or unfair competition. Then I think the two biggies, and these would probably be the ones that would get the most look, would be trade secret and patents. So until you're convinced that all you have is a patent case, given Meta's successful history in defending patent cases, I would really want to make sure that I couldn't raise other IP claims as part of the case. But, you know, if that's where you are at the end of your analysis process and there's pressure to get a case on file, then I think, you'll do what a lot of patent plaintiffs do, try to file, you know, a case involving multiple patents. That helps protect against IPR risk, have a strong infringement read as much as possible, and I think do whatever you can to see if you could get the case filed in Texas as opposed to the Northern District of California. And none of this is going to be new to this audience, but I think what works for other patent plaintiffs is going to be the types of things that Twitter chooses to do as well if they ever got to the point where they were filing a patent case against Meta.
You started this discussion by saying patent litigation is emotional, right? It's emotional even for the attorneys involved. You know, they get very emotional about the cases sometimes, in-house and outside counsel. They feel personally wronged on behalf of their clients and so forth.
You're 100% right, Eli. Like when we're involved in a patent case and representing a client, it's literally on our minds all the time. I mean, even as a young associate, I always felt an obligation to think about the cases that I was working on. And I would think about the cases I was working on. And it's hard not to get emotional about a case. It's an adversarial process. You know there's a lot at stake. Inevitably, the lawyers on the other side do things that, you know, make you mad at them and vice versa. So there is a level of emotion that's involved in a patent case. And that's one of the reasons why it's good to bring in, you know, kind of dispassionate, independent observers to kind of take a look at the case with a fresh set of eyes along the way. Now here, I think we're still early enough in the process that the real question is going to boil down to, you know, Elon Musk has, you know, called them copycats. He's already shown by sending the letter from Quinn Emanuel to Meta that he's not scared to engage his lawyers in terms of representing Twitter's interests and trying to push them forward. The question really is going to be, how far does his emotion or the emotion around this situation push both sides? Does it push them to try to see if they could avoid litigation and come to, you know, some kind of mediated negotiation that resolves any potential claims? Or does it bring us to the point where a case gets filed and now you're starting the cycle of, you know, filed case, maybe a countersuit, and, you know, setting yourself up for many years of litigation back and forth?
The limiting factor a lot of times is the economics, right?
Right.
The budgets that you have, if you can get a settlement that makes sense, you know, usually a company kind of settles and the attorneys have to kind of deal with that mentally. But here you have two parties that have, I guess, theoretically endless resources. Musk and Zuckerberg, you know, it seems they have some personal animosity as well based on the tweets challenging each other to fight and so forth. What do you think will happen, I guess, during that litigation that might make them think twice about continuing this battle?
We should really start by thinking, what could be possible motivations for Elon Musk to get in the ring with Mark Zuckerberg in the first place, right? If we're going to personify their corporations to that extent. Why would Twitter choose to try to battle this out in the courts in the first place? Because we're, you know, I guess our operating assumption in this conversation is that if a case is going to get filed, it's going to get filed by Twitter, you know, alleging some kind of IP infringement. So within that framework, I think, you know, if I were advising Elon Musk, I would, you know, start game planning and saying, what are our motivations for filing this case? And what are the range of outcomes that we think are acceptable, you know, that would justify the cost, the expense, the business disruption, the risk in the court of public opinion of being aggressive in this situation? And, you know, part of what you would consider is, all right, maybe there's a universe whereby bringing this case, it actually is a way of opening the conversation about Meta acquiring Twitter, right? Elon Musk owns it. It's a personal asset of his, right? And maybe, you know, maybe
the first.
Right. Yeah. Right. Maybe this is a, you know, maybe this is a indirect way of, you know, using the litigation process to lead to a buyout. And I wouldn't discount anything at this stage of the process. But even if the goal is not to get Meta to consider buying Twitter, I think part of the what's uncertain going forward is what's Twitter's real future in the marketplace. Is this something? Are they going to want to go public again at some point in the future? You know, are they, you know, prepared to compete for market share with Threads over time? There's a lot of marketing benefit that a company in Twitter's position could potentially gain by painting themselves as the innovator and by using the legal process to kind of create that impression in the marketplace that, hey, you know, you could choose to be on Threads because you happen to have a Facebook account, but if you want to be with the original and the best, right, the best content and the best creators and the best network, you should stay with Twitter because we're the innovators. So, you know, obviously there's always a range of settlement that's available in any IP dispute in terms of resolving it. And I think that's one of the things that you have to think about before you file a case, which is what would be an acceptable outcome, what would be a beneficial outcome, and what would be an outcome that we would, you know, grit our teeth, but we would bear it.
So that's interesting. And I'm assuming you're saying, you know, they'll file a suit when they think there's some bigger benefit to filing a suit than there isn't. And they'll settle when they think there's a bigger benefit to settling than continuing with a suit, which could be any of the, for example, if they go public, but they might think, the public markets might think the suit is a distraction, or the settlement might send some kind of positive signal, that's when they might finally decide to settle in anticipation of something like that.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. Yeah, I think that makes sense. I think that's assuming that everybody's being rational actors, right? Now, one of the fun things about emotion, especially when you're on the outside looking in, is it could be very entertaining to see people with unlimited resources decide not to act rationally and to put those resources to work to try to extract maximum punishment from the other side. So, you know, at any time we're talking about a patent case where there's literal discussion of whether the two owners of the company are going to like engage in some kind of MMA battle, I think we're in for a lot of interesting possibilities going forward, perhaps a lot more interesting than just, you know, another Texas case that gets filed and, you know, Facebook files some IPRs and a motion to transfer to the Northern District of California. So stay tuned. It's a very interesting a ride that we may be in for based on what we've known so far.
Does the size of Meta's portfolio mean anything? The fact that they can file way more lawsuits or anything like that, does that kind of inform how you think this might play out?
You know, I think what boils down to is maybe one of the ways to think about this situation right now is to say, what type of case are we going to be looking at? Is it going to be a trade secret-based case like Uber Waymo, where Google had a lot of leverage over Uber because of the strength of the trade secret claims that they could be? Or is there really no trade secret claim that Twitter is able to bring? And this is just going to be a back and forth patent battle between two well-resourced companies. And there you have, you know, cases like Apple Samsung or Google Sonos, which is still going on right now, which is you basically see companies engage in a lot of patent litigation that takes years to unfold, ultimately to settle and kind of fight themselves to a stalemate. So I think for the short term, and one of the things that we should focus on if we do see a case filed is whether or not the case includes trade secret type claims or other types of IP claims that could potentially make it about more than just a patent infringement claim. That could go a long way towards helping us understand what's really the risk here for both sides, you know, and what's the potential benefit for both sides if they're able to succeed.
You know, this actually kind of brings me to the last point I was going to make and where we started this conversation. Me looking at the portfolio, you talking about how patent litigation losses ultimately come down to the assets that you're asserting. Would it have mattered if Twitter did anything differently historically, way before Elon Musk came into the picture? You know, instead of pushing that innovator's patent agreement, which kind of made people within their company not want to pursue patents, if they kind of stressed building a robust, strong patent portfolio that went after every single possible feature that they came up with in every single possible way, what impact would it have?
I think it's a very good question. You know, the defense litigator in me says it probably doesn't really matter, right? Because no matter what patents Twitter asserts against Meta, Meta's going to feel that those patents have weaknesses and can be defeated, right? And their lawyers are going to tell them the same thing. And they're going to spend a lot of time, money, both with their in-house lawyers, outside lawyers, and you know, experts to come up with the best possible arguments to knock down whatever patents Twitter puts in front of them. I also think that because of the nature of the business that Twitter's in, and the, you know, the uncertainty, to put it mildly, around what's really a valid patent from an analyst perspective, from an eligibility perspective, you know, when we start getting into the realm of social networks and the technology underpinning social networks, I think there's a valid question as could Twitter have actually done more than it did, right? You know, maybe it could have ended up with more patents, but would those have necessarily been better patents? I think that's up for debate. So, you know, from the defense perspective, I don't think that had Twitter been more aggressive or adopted an IBM type approach of a, you know, patent first and ask questions later, you know, patent everything possible, and you know, and then try to build as big a portfolio as you can. I don't know that it would make much of a difference here. I think for you know, for purposes of thinking about whether or not Twitter has enough assets or good enough assets to even bring a claim against Meta in the first place, I think that's an analysis that's being done, you know, probably as we speak. And depending on the answer, you know, someone's going to maybe have a very encouraging or potentially even uncomfortable conversation with Elon Musk about what options are available to the company in terms of the patents that they actually have. So it's always interesting to think about, you know, what could have gone differently had the company taken a different approach. But at the same time, you know, we have to balance that, you know, the inclination to say, oh, they couldn't, should have done more with, you know, looking at the context of the business they operate in, you know, some of the challenges that similar companies have had in terms of asserting their patents because of the uncertainty around patent eligibility. And, you know, the reality in litigation, which is that you could have 1,000 patent portfolio, but when you get in front of a jury, it's probably going to be on, you know, 2, maybe 3 of those patents that you're able to, you know, successfully assert and run through the gauntlet of IPRs and Alice and all the defenses that a defendant can do. So at the end of the day, you know, we may be in a position 2 years from now if the case is filed in Texas, or, you know, 3 or 4 years from now if it's filed in California or transferred to California, or maybe even longer with the IPRs. But at some point in time, if this goes all the way and there's a lawyer for Twitter standing in front of a jury in a closing argument, you know, you can imagine that the number of patents that's going to be at dispute in that moment, what they're asking the jury to decide on is going to be a handful of patents. And the rest of the portfolio is just going to be along for the ride. So, you know, there's a lot of factors that go into patent portfolio construction, but from the purposes of litigation, it's really a priority on identifying your strongest assets and preparing the strongest possible case based on the assets that you actually have access to.
Thank you for listening to Clause 8, the voice of IP. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with others and leave a 5-star rating in your favorite podcatcher. We'd also like to thank Harity & Harity LLP for their generous support. For more information, visit voiceofip.com. And don't forget to check out our full archive of past episodes. Clause 8 is a Brouhaha audio production. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.